Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey everyone, we got a special episode for you today here on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm going to share with you an interview that I just did with John DeRosa for his Classical Theism podcast. John is a great interviewer. He really understands how to be a good Catholic casemaker, how to use philosophy to show God exists, and how to use history to show God became man and established the Catholic Church. So this is an interview I really enjoyed, and honestly, one of the most fun interviews I've been able to take part in recently, because John and I are really on the same wavelength when it comes to a lot of these issues, and I think you'll see that in our interview. So I hope you enjoy it, and if you'd like to hear more interviews like this and check out some of our bonus content we have up this week, including my little insider's trips for how to evangelize Muslims and talk about the evidence for and against Islam, do of course visit TrentHornPodcast.com. But without further ado, here is my interview with John DeRosa for the Classical Theism Podcast.
And the way I see it, the Catholic-Christian worldview rests on three main pillars. It's kind of how I describe it at ClassicalTheism.com. We say it rests on the pillars that God exists, that Jesus is our Lord and Messiah, and that he founded the Catholic Church. Now, as Catholic casemakers, we want to become proficient in talking about each of those three areas, God, Jesus, and the Church. Do you think that's a helpful way of carving up the apologetics territory?
Yes, I think it is helpful. I mean, this is a path that I had to embrace, the path that I had to follow in my own conversion. I mean, I believed there was a God out there, but I had a very limited, incorrect view of who God is. But I still believe that in God, I just didn't believe in Jesus or his church. So first, I had to be convinced of who Jesus was. And then after that, I became convinced of the church having a divine origin in Christ and being founded and established by him. So yeah, I like to think of it as like stair steps, you know, meet people where they're at. You can't really argue about whether Jesus is fully present in the Eucharist with an atheist until you can come to the conclusion that God exists and he can perform miracles. If you don't have that, most of our faith seems absurd if there is no God who can do the miraculous. So you have to reach people where they're at, whether they need to be convinced that God exists, that God became man in the person of Jesus, or that Jesus established the Catholic Church.
Good point. And we're going to dive into each of those three areas a little bit on this episode. But before that, what are some crucial basic skills that you think we need as Catholic casemakers? I'm not talking about the intellectual knowledge just yet, but you know, some practical tips or practical skills, tactics that we need to master to just become more confident and more effective in our conversations about the faith.
I think the one skill that we have to master is really a good understanding of logic and reasoning and understanding evidence. That's why it's so important that in order to do good theology, you have to do good philosophy first. If you don't know how to think clearly, you're just going to come up with a theology that doesn't really make sense and has to retreat into fideism to say, well, this is just what I believe and that's what I believe, and it doesn't matter if it doesn't make sense or not. So understanding the rules of logic, fallacies, how there can be errors in people's reasoning, how an argument works, whether it's a deductive argument from premises to a conclusion that's demonstrated with certainty, or an inductive argument with based on probabilistic reasoning. How to see that, one, how to make your own good arguments, and when someone gives you an argument in response or an objection, how to analyze it and see if there are weaknesses or fallacies or errors in the other person's argument. And to be a casemaker, that's probably one of the most, aside from the important skills you need in your spiritual life, the most important analytic skill, I believe, is the ability to understand arguments, to dissect them, and to do so in a winsome way, in a conversational way. That's what I do on Catholic Answers Live. When I'm on the radio show, I'm dissecting arguments in my head, but I don't say stuff like, well, the second premise on your argument appears to have is not sufficiently founded. You also committed the fallacy of the undistributed middle when you said this. Just like, you know, I ask questions like, well, how does it follow? How do you know that X? Or how does it follow that, you know, I might say something, well, help me understand this. Okay, so how does it follow that if the Bible has errors, that you should be an atheist? I don't understand that, because at most, if the Bible has errors, you could just believe in God and Jesus and the church, and the Bible has some errors in it. It's just not fully without error. Why do you jump all the way to atheism? Now, I could say, well, that's actually the fallacy of the non sequitur. It doesn't follow, the conclusion of atheism doesn't follow from your premises. It is. It's a non sequitur fallacy. But we have to be careful as case makers, understand the arguments, communicate them well. And part of communicating well is not using jargon. Be very wary about throwing jargon around. It's helpful in some cases, but a lot of times it can just confuse people, and you're just kind of doing it to sound smart, and it doesn't come off super well.
That is an awesome tip. I'm dying over here from that impression. But I will tell you, my wife is an optometrist, and when she was in school for optometry, I actually went in and like was a practice patient when she was like learning how to do the exams and everything. And one of the things that they were tested on is, well, okay, can you, you know, do the diagnosis, do the test, and then how do you explain it to the patient in regular language without using all that jargon? So I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's a good everyday thing. And then me as a math teacher, we talk about it all the time with my students. You know, if you can't convey the idea simply, then you don't have a good enough understanding of it, and you got to go back to the drawing board. So that's a great tip for us, Trent. I think jargon and just acting like, you know, all intellectual, naming these fallacies can really turn people off. We want to be conversational and inviting, and you do a great job of that on the radio.
Thank you. And this is something I see, especially on the internet, in com boxes and comment sections on the internet.
Yes.
Atheists are very fond of doing this. They say, that's fallacy. That's special pleading. And most of the time when they throw out these fallacies, it doesn't actually apply. That's not what it means. The other thing that happens, though, too, both atheists and Christians don't realize this. There is one overarching fallacy that is often forgotten. That is called the fallacy of the fallacy, which basically goes like this. Just because an argument has a fallacy in it, it does not follow the conclusion is false. Now the argument could be invalid. It doesn't prove its conclusion, but you could have reasoned your way to the correct conclusion through invalid reasoning, through happenstance. So you might say, you know, this argument has a fallacy. You know, this argument for God has a fallacy in it. Therefore, God does not exist. That doesn't prove it. No, it doesn't. It just proves that argument for God doesn't work, not that God doesn't exist.
Oh, sure. So that's a great point. We were just doing an SAT question in classes for multiple choices, and someone, you know, raises their hand. They give some reasoning, and they got the right answer, but the reasoning was not right at all. It's just you happen to get lucky.
Yes, and that's funny. In philosophy, and as I said before, the key to being a good apologist and casemaker, you got to know philosophy. Along with theology, if not philosophy, almost more so sometimes. This is a debate among philosophers about the definition of knowledge. What does it mean to have knowledge? Now, the traditional view of knowledge, and this is a working definition, knowledge is justified true belief. If I believe something and it's true, and I have a good reason for believing that, well, then I know that that is the case. If it's just a true belief, it could be a lucky guess. But if I have a justification, then it's knowledge. But the problem is, and in philosophy, these are called Gettier counterexamples, is that you could have cases where you believe something, it's true, and you have a good reason for believing it, but it turns out it's false, or you could have simply not known it at all. So one example that comes up is I'm driving through the countryside, and I see a barn. And it appears to be a barn, and my vision is correct. I have total justification. And I look, and I go up to investigate it, and it does certainly turn out to be a barn. But then a half mile down the road, there is a barn facade that looks exactly like that. And if I had just stopped a half mile down the road, I would have made the exact same inference and gotten it wrong, that it was just a facade. It was just a decoration. It's a Potakim barn. Your listeners can look up a Potakim village to see what that is.
Oh, interesting.
So a Potakim village is a fake village that's set up for propaganda purposes.
Gotcha.
The North Koreans have built several of them along the DMZ.
Wow.
So Potakim village. So the idea here is, oh, wait a minute. Did I really know that was a barn there? Because if I had stopped half mile down the road, I would have said the same thing and been wrong. So the point I give up here is, yeah, that you could get your way to a conclusion incorrectly, but you should still examine an argument. That our goal is casemakers. Our goal as casemakers, when we put forward our arguments, is to make sure the premises are true, the reasons we use to support the conclusion are true, and the conclusion logically follows from those reasons. So an argument is valid if it doesn't have any logical errors in it. And it is sound if it has no errors and the premises are true. Our goal as case makers is to make sound arguments and point out unsound or invalid arguments.
I think that's a great summary. And it stresses the importance of philosophy, and which is something we stress a lot on this show too, and how, you know, no one can avoid philosophy. You know, even if you try to say, well, you're not doing philosophy, a lot of times you'll just end up doing it badly. So thank you for those summary points, Trent. I want to head into some tips, just more specifically on those three pillars, God, Jesus, and the church.
Sure.
When we're talking about God's existence, you know, sometimes you have a call-in show, Why Are You an Atheist?, where people have to explain, or you've done debates. What are some helpful summary points or things to remember in those conversations when we're talking to unbelievers who aren't sure about God, or maybe they're a hardened atheist? What are some things we need to remember in making effective conversations there?
Well, I think first we should remember that the biggest hurdle is probably going to be scientism. This other person will believe that God is like any other being in the universe. And to prove God exists, you just need good scientific evidence, a machine, an experiment, something that's demonstrable, repeatable. And if you want to show anything exists, you got to have hard scientific evidence. And that misunderstands the question of God's existence is not a scientific question. It is a philosophical question. Science deals with material forces and objects in the universe. There could be immaterial things, moral truths, minds, abstract objects, numbers, parallel universes. There's these things we can't see, but are still real. They exist, and their existence is a philosophical question. So you need the person to see, no, science tells us a lot, but it can never answer this question. We have to use philosophy to do that. And we're not talking about whether God is a being in the universe we can find. God just is infinite being that is the ground of all that exists. He's the ultimate foundation of reality. So I think that's one thing we have to put forward and help people see that our arguments for God are not God of the gaps arguments. We're not saying, I don't know, therefore God. We're saying that we see the world around us. We can use logic and inference to get to the conclusion there is an ultimate ground of reality beyond this universe that has divine attributes, and we can logically reason that. We're not just punting the mystery, basically.
Very good. I think that's a very important point about refuting scientism. I'll refer listeners back. I did an interview with Dr. J.P. Moreland, who's a Christian recently. He has a book out, Refuting Scientism, and also Dr. Edward Fazer has written a lot about that. And you yourself, Trent, have spoken and shown why that is not the case. That people shouldn't just be relying on scientific evidence to answer a philosophical question. You mentioned some arguments there, or you kind of, you know, suggested that we are arguing from the world back to God. Could you give us a little bit more insight as to, you know, what you're thinking about regarding arguments for God? What are some of your go-to arguments in a conversation with an atheist, either on the radio or in a debate? And, you know, if you had to just pick a couple, maybe two or three, which arguments would you choose, and why do you think they're effective?
Well, there's lots of different arguments I believe can be effective with different people. And an argument's effectiveness doesn't depend solely on its premises and its reasoning. It also depends on the person who's hearing it. Some people are just more predisposed to certain kinds of arguments. So they're just moved by different kinds of evidences. And so you have to reach those people with those kinds of evidences. In my book, Answering Atheism, I put forward four arguments, the argument from contingency, the Kalam argument, fine-tuning, and the argument from moral facts. Recently, I included in an appendix Thomas Aquinas' arguments, though in my recent debate with Dan Barker, I ended up sticking with the argument from motion, Thomas's first way, the philosophical Kalam argument, and the contingency argument, Leibniz's contingency argument. I think I also did, I also did a moral argument. I jumped off the problem of evil and gave a moral argument for God from moral facts. So there's different arguments I find helpful. I think the key to the best arguments for the existence of God are those that start with the most obvious premises. That's why in recent years, even in my book Answering Atheism on the Kalam argument, I said in that book, I wrote that, you know, six years ago, that I believe the argument that the universe began to exist, I like that argument because it's easier for people to wrap their heads around it than the contingency argument, for example. But you can get a lot of people that naysay, like, well, we don't know Big Bang cosmology, and it's very speculative. So that's why I in answering atheism, I even said, well, the philosophical argument, I think, is more what I'm putting my money in, and the scientific evidence is just kind of icing on the cake. So I like that argument because it's easier to wrap your head around. But the contingency argument and the argument for motion can rely on just a lot more self-evident premises dealing with change or existence. So the argument, your argument's good if it has premises like, yeah, I believe that, yeah, I believe that. The less they'll challenge the premise, the stronger the argument is going to be. Yeah, you have to think these things through, and you have to pick a certain argument and really dive into it. If you want to be a good case maker, not just a popularizer, you've got to get the argument and then all of the cascading objections and replies, and it just takes a fair amount of work. And it's the same with, you know, these arguments we just shared here, like Kalam. If you want to defend Kalam, have at it. Just get ready to see all the different avenues the argument's going to turn down.
That's a great point. And I think you did a nice job in the debate with Dan Barker presenting all four of those arguments. And actually, that's why I love the contingency argument and the first way argument for motion so much, is because they don't depend on all of that theoretical physics and beginning of the universe. You can just use some well-grounded philosophy to make that point.
And that's why I put them in there. And that's why, I mean, Dan, it was the most, my jaw almost dropped when he said in the debate, during his rebuttal, he says, those arguments, they're just words. I'm like, what? And I think anyone who cared about the truth would see at that moment, Dan was just in over his head and just did not want to have to reply to them. And he was not dealing with just some fundamentalist preacher. He just wanted to ignore that stuff because he knew if he tried to critique them, I would have a reply for the ready at him. And so, yeah, I thought that was very humorous.
Let's transition to Jesus, the second pillar. If we're talking God exists, you know, we're talking about Jesus and we're talking about the church. What are a couple of helpful tips for conversations that center around Christ? You know, people want to know, why follow Jesus and not some other religious figure? What should we keep in mind in that type of conversation?
Well, I think what we should keep in mind is the uniqueness of who Christ is, specifically the uniqueness of his claims to divinity, his claims of having unique sonship and authority as the only son of the Father beyond any merely human prophet, and also the uniqueness of the historical evidence for his resurrection from the dead. I think that makes Jesus different than other prophets, other leaders of other religions. And when all that is put together, that cumulative evidence, it begs the question, who is Jesus and how do you explain the rise of Christianity? And I think the naturalistic theories, the non-Christian theories, don't succeed. And so we have to just keep that in mind. And of course, when we talk about Jesus as casemakers, we move from being philosophers to being historians. And so we have to understand principles of history and historiography when we do that.
That's a great point that we transition in our role there. And in the debate with Dan Barker, you do a very nice job of defending the resurrection of Jesus. And you defended the resurrection well in books, but Dan raised an objection in his closing statement that you didn't get to respond to. And you commented on, I think it was a podcast episode, where you said it was really bad form, and I agree. There's been...
I just had to sit there. And watching the debate, if it goes back to me, I just have to sit there and pleasantly smile and nod my head. Because the thing in debates, if you're a casemaker and you feel called to do debates, I'd love to... you know, mentor more Catholics who can get out there and do debates if you're good at it. But you have to remember, in a debate, it's half of it's what you say, but also you get judged in a debate simply how you react to the other guy. I've watched debates where Christians like sit there and they have deer in the headlight look, and it just looks like they lost because they look startled, and you can't do that. So, and mostly I wasn't startled. I was mad when Dan was doing this because that's not how debates work. I was ready after my defense of the resurrection for Dan to deal with that in a rebuttal or to continue our discussion into cross-examination and cross-examine him and his response to the evidence of the resurrection, because I don't think it's very good. And there's key points where it can be exploited. But he didn't do it. He just saved all of his rebuttal to my evidence for his closing statement, which in a debate, you're not supposed to do that. The closing statement is the time where you re-summarize everything that happened in the debate and represent your evidence and your replies for one last time to the audience. When you bring up new arguments or new rebuttals that your opponent cannot respond to, yeah, it's just not proper form. And so you're right. He did bring up a few points on the resurrection. I'm like, well, you know, hopefully I'll reply to them somewhere else, or people will see I just can't reply here.
Well, I'm going to give you a chance right now, because Dan, he really only made two objections to the resurrection in the whole debate. He said, one, he said the stories are contradictory. They don't have their story straight. There's too many discrepancies in the accounts. And then his second argument was kind of new. I will give him that. It was kind of new. It's just a shame. Like you said, it came in the closing. I hadn't heard this before, but he said Catholic apologists, Christian apologists make a big deal that there were women at the tomb. But this isn't evidence of anything at all, because there were always women at the tombs in the ancient world. We should expect that, and there's nothing significant about it. And if Christians were going to conjure up a story, then it's very plausible that they would have women at the tomb. So, Trent, I'm going to give you a chance right here, just in a few minutes. I know you can't go into all the details, but
sure.
How would you respond to those points?
Well, the point is, and as Christians, yeah, we don't want to overstate our evidence. So some people put it, and I've done this too, you know, you phrase things too simply, that the idea that a woman's testimony was worthless in the ancient world, that's not entirely true. What I say is that her testimony was extremely limited, like a criminal's testimony or a child's. So in the ancient Jewish society, a woman could really only testify about private matters that only she would know about. So things like whether she had reached the age of menstruation, or whether her husband was still alive, whether she was still married, those are things she could testify about. But if it was a public matter where a man's testimony could be preferred over a woman's, you would take the man's testimony over the woman's. And so if you were making up a story about Jesus' tomb being empty, you would supply male witnesses. It's not true. Dan is right that, yeah, women would anoint the body. But think about this. Jesus' body was anointed before being placed in the tomb. The women go to the tomb to anoint it, but then they, you know, they have to say to themselves, who will roll away the stone for us? Oh, well, maybe somebody will be there. So already, if you're making up the story, you're saying, oh, so the women went to the tomb to anoint the body, and they just hoped somebody would be there to roll the stone away. Whereas if I was making up the story, you could say the women went to the tomb to anoint the body, and Peter and John went with them to roll the stone away. And then they were there, and Peter and John, along with the women, saw the tomb was empty. And look what you've got. You have corroboration now. You've got something that would make sense in the ancient world. So when you go 100 years later, 150 years later, in the Gospel of Peter, the empty tomb is witnessed by the apostles, the Romans, the Jews, and the women come later, and they don't serve a purpose in the narrative, except it was just common knowledge that they really were the ones who saw it. So it's funny, in the later apocryphal gospels, the women's testimony is devalued, and men are put in that place. So it's not true, though, there would just be only women at the tomb. Like at Lazarus, when Lazarus walked out of his tomb, there were men and women weeping there. So if the body had already been anointed, you could have said the women and the men were at Jesus' tomb weeping, and then saw that. What is very peculiar is that you only have women in this story. In fact, in the story, the apostles don't believe the women. They don't believe them. They go to the tomb to see for themselves. Even the evangelists themselves have to recognize this regular unbelief people have towards female witnesses. And yet they still preserve it. So Dan is just incorrect there. Yeah, there's a reason the women would be there, but it's not a reason that they alone would be there. So the objection still doesn't hold up.
Oh, man, I wish he brought that up in rebuttal. That was, you just did that about 2 or 3 minutes. That was a great response. And hopefully the audience, maybe some of them are listening to this. I'm going to link to your debate in the show notes page of this episode. Is it out yet on YouTube? Can we watch it?
Oh, here's the thing. Yeah, do wait for it. We just got the debate sent to Catholic Answers. So we got the debate. It's here. Because before it was just on the university website. The university sent us the final edited version. It should be up on YouTube this week or next, which makes it a lot easier to share than what was on the university website. But I'll get you the final version once it's ready.
Awesome. I think by the time this podcast is published, I think we'll be able to link to that in the show notes page. Just real quick, I'm going to cut this out of the interview. Trent, do you have 5 or 10 more minutes? I apologize because we're just on the cusp of the 45-minute block I asked of you.
Yeah, that's fine. I got a few more minutes.
Do you want to wrap it up? We'll just do 5 minutes. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine. Sure.
Okay. All right, Trent, we've talked about God's existence and we talked about Jesus. Lastly, I'd like to talk about the Catholic Church. What do you think is important to keep in mind when defending the Church? What are some big points we need to know? And what ideas do we need to study to become more confident in defending the Church?
Well, I think in order to defend the Church, it's just helpful to know, one, what the Church actually teaches. So having a good knowledge of the catechism, that many times Protestants will accuse us of believing things that we do not believe. So one, just understanding that, this is what the church teaches. This is what is dogma. This is doctrine. This is a Protestant saying, oh, you believe in limbo or this or that. There's no evidence for that. You say, well, that's not a doctrine of the church. That's theological speculation. And a lot of people have speculated it, but it never rose to the level of doctrine. And just other things like that, or indulgences is something the Catholic Church did so people could have a ticket out of hell. Well, no, an indulgence doesn't forgive a single sin. An indulgence is a remission of the temporal punishment for sins. So part of it there is just knowing what the church teaches in very fine detail. Second is just knowing the Bible very well. When you know the Bible well, you can point out to a Protestant friend, that's not what that verse means, or that is not a good interpretation of that verse. That doesn't support what you're talking about. So Protestants try to make it seem like they're the Bible Christians. But I think when we know the Bible well and can use it, we shouldn't fall into the trap of thinking we have to support everything we believe from Scripture explicitly, because we don't believe in sola scriptura. But we can use Scripture to show that consistently and comprehensively it supports the Catholic view. So I think as a Catholic case maker, you'll want to focus on knowledge of Scripture and the Catechism, and then after that, the testimony of the Church Fathers, especially the Apostolic Fathers, will give you just a lot of great resources when you're evangelizing.
Trent, thank you so much for all the work you do at Catholic Answers, at the Council of Trent podcast. I'm going to link to a whole slew of your stuff in the show notes page for this episode, because I want people to know you. I want them to listen to you. Members of this audience are informed. They're people who are studying the faith, they're studying philosophy, and they want to go out there and defend Catholic Christian ideas and conversation. So thank you so much for joining us on the Classical Theism podcast. If you could just give us a quick sneak peek at what you're working on currently and where listeners can go to find more about your work, and then we'll say goodbye.
Sure thing. I'm currently writing a book now on Jesus called Counterfeit Christs, How to Find the Real Jesus Among the Imposters. I'm also producing a daily podcast called The Council of Trent, C-O-U-N-S-E-L, and you can check that out at trenthornpodcast.com. And I'm grateful you had me on the show, and I hope your listeners will learn more about what I do and check out more of your episodes as well.
Thank you, Trent. Thank you so much, and have a great day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit trenthornpodcast.com.